Well, in the book of Galatians, the Apostle Paul pronounces an anathema, that is, a curse, upon anyone who would pervert the gospel of Christ. Turn with me to Galatians chapter 1, and let's see exactly what he says. And you will see very plainly that this is not something that the pulpit committees today would handle very well. I'm sure that if a minister were to do this today, he would get a letter from the pulpit committee saying that you have offended some of the brethren, your language is much too strong, now it's going to be difficult to minister to them. But notice how the Apostle Paul phrases this, and it is obvious that whatever is in view here is a very, very serious problem. In Galatians chapter 1, beginning in verse 6, I'm reading from the English Standard Version today, Paul says, I am astonished that you are so quickly deserting him who called you in the grace of Christ and are turning to a different gospel. Not that there is another one, but there are some who trouble you and want to distort the gospel of Christ. So he's saying there's only one gospel, but whoever these people are distorting it in such a way that, in effect, it is becoming a different gospel. It's something that has a different message to it in some way, and we'll examine that a little later. But even if we apostles, we ministers, we who preach the gospel, even if we or an angel from heaven should preach to you a gospel contrary to the one we preach to you, let him be accursed, or let him be anathema. As we have said before, and notice the emphasis here, as we said before, let him, so I say again, if anyone is preaching to you a gospel contrary to the one you received, let him be accursed. Very, very strong language. So it is obvious that whatever this corruption of the gospel was that was spreading in the Galatian church or churches was very serious. It was a threat. Paul didn't look upon it lightly. It was not one of those things about which we can agree to disagree. It was something very, very serious. Now, so obviously someone was distorting the gospel there. How can you do that? How can you distort the gospel? Well, a couple of different ways. One way is to eliminate certain essential truths from it. Just take away certain essential truths and you will distort the gospel. If you take Christ out of the gospel, you have no gospel. Or if you start to redefine who Christ is, you distort the gospel. You can add also a second way then is you can add foreign elements to the gospel, things that are in some way contradictory to the good news message itself. Gospel, of course, meaning good news. With this in mind then, go to Galatians chapter 4 and let's see some of the specifics that Paul refers to, some things he mentions in particular in this overall context, the distortion of the gospel. In Galatians chapter 4, and this is a passage that's important to us, important to you, because of what you're going to be doing next week. You'll be observing the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And if you check just about any commentary, you will find that most of them, at least, would say that what Paul is referring to here is, or at least includes, what you're going to be doing next week. Let's read it. In Galatians chapter 4, and beginning in verse 8, Paul says, "Formerly, when you did not know God, you were enslaved to those who by nature are not gods." Obviously, he's talking to Gentile converts, former idolaters. You were enslaved to those which by nature are not gods. That's who he's talking to very clearly. But now that you have come to know God, or rather to be known by God, how can you turn back again to the weak and worthless elementary principles of the world whose slaves you want to be once more? You observe days and months and seasons and years. I am afraid I may have labored over you in vain. Now, if you look at just this text in isolation, a very logical conclusion would be that these people, these former idolaters, were now going back into some kind of practice associated with idolatry. And the reason that would be a very logical conclusion based on this text in isolation is because it says, how can you turn back again to these weak and beggarly elements and once again be enslaved to them? So once we establish these were former idolaters, and that's what it means, obviously, when it says when you did not know God, you were enslaved to things which by nature are not God's. He's talking about, if you examine the Galatians, look back, we won't go back there, but back in Acts chapter 14, when Paul was in, at least in southern Galatia, and it's not clear whether he's talking to, he's writing to northern Galatian peoples or southern Galatia. I don't think it matters, because throughout the whole region, I think you'd find much the same thing. When he was in southern Galatia, he ran into idolaters. There were statues, no doubt, of Zeus there and Hermes and other of the pagan gods. And in fact, when a healing occurred there, when the Apostle Paul, God worked through the Apostle Paul and Barnabas in giving a man who was not able to walk, suddenly sprang up and began walking, everybody says, the gods have come down to us in the form of men. And they thought that Barnabas, because he seemed to be doing well, we thought that Paul was Hermes since he was doing most of the speaking, and they thought that Barnabas must be Zeus. So Zeus and Hermes had come down to us, and they wanted to go out and offer sacrifices to them. And they tore their garments, and that's in those days they did that to express a very strong feeling about what was going on. So they tore their garments and says, men, don't let this happen. And even though they talked to him about it, said, no, you should not do this. We're men like you are. They still could barely restrain them from offering sacrifices. So that's the kind of thing you found going on in that region, in the churches, or I should say, in the communities in Galatia. And so he's obviously referring to that background when he says you were enslaved to those things which by nature are not gods. In other words, they worshiped them as gods, but they were not gods. They were idols, in other words. And when he says, now you're going back to the weak and beggarly elements, as it says in the King James Version, you're going back to that, it would seem from just this text alone that they're going back into something associated with idolatry. These days and months and seasons and years seem to be connected with idolatry. So that's a logical conclusion, or at least it's a logical explanation. However, there are other things we ought to consider in the process. I want you to go back, for example, to Galatians chapter 2. Galatians chapter 2. Let's look at the broader context. We've looked at that text in isolation. We have come to a reasonable explanation based on what the text says, and looking at it linguistically, it does what we've said doesn't violate anything in the grammar. But now let's look at the broader context of the book of Galatians and see if by chance we could come to some other conclusion. Now what I'm doing here is pointing out how difficult some of these texts can be. Because the fact is, we don't have all the facts in terms of the cultural situation there. We don't know exactly and precisely who these heretics were. We might assume they were Pharisees, and perhaps they were. We might assume that they were the Essenes, perhaps they were. But we're not really certain as to the character and nature of the heretics. We only have what the book tells us about them. But there may be a lot more in the background that would shed significant light on the subject if we knew it. But let's take what we do have. Look at Galatians chapter 2 and begin, and let's start reading. Paul is setting up the argument here. In verse 11, he says, but when Cephas, that's Simon Peter, came to Antioch, I opposed him to his face because he stood condemned. For before certain men came from James, he was eating with the Gentiles, but when they came, he drew back and separated himself, fearing the circumcision party. Now, why would he be concerned about that? What does this mean that he drew back, he separated himself? What in the world was going on here? We can't relate to that because we're in an entirely different cultural situation. That's not something we would even think about. If you're eating with somebody of a different culture, a different race, a different ethnic background, whatever, you'd think nothing of it. If some of your friends showed up, or some of the people from your ethnic background showed up, you would introduce them. Peter gets up and removes himself. What's going on here? Well, you have to understand a little something about Jewish tradition and what they considered the oral law. Wes talked about that some time ago. But as you recall, there were certain commands or laws or rules within Jewish tradition, the so-called oral law, now preserved in the Talmud and other Jewish writings that have come about since the destruction of Jerusalem and the Jerusalem temple in AD 70. But in any case, for a Jewish man, an observant Jew, to sit at the table with, to have table fellowship with the uncircumcised, was to do something that was not considered proper as far as the Jewish tradition was concerned. So there was Peter eating with the uncircumcised. Now, why would he be doing that? Because if you go back to Acts chapter 15, you see very plainly that God had revealed to him directly and personally that he was not to call any man common or unclean. And Peter himself says at the Jerusalem conference that God has received them just like he's received us. And there's no separation between the two. So there he is enjoying table fellowship with his brethren who happen to be among those not circumcised, the Gentiles. And then when these, obviously, these observant Jews, from, it says from James, must have come up from Jerusalem, when they come to the place where they were meeting, Peter sees them and he gets up and he quietly removes himself because he doesn't want to cause any contention. You know, he doesn't want to cause, he says, for fear of them. And then Paul goes on to say, and the rest, verse 13, the rest of the Jews acted hypocritically along with him, so that even Barnabas was led astray by their hypocrisy. When I saw that their conduct was not in step with the truth of the gospel, I said to Cephas before them all, if you, though a Jew, live like a Gentile and not like a Jew, how can you force the Gentiles to live like Jews? What he means here is that if you here are having table fellowship with Gentiles, you're not living like a Jew, an observant Jew. You're living like a Gentile. You know, they don't have any problem with it. You have, but the Jews, many of the Jews, the observant Jews do. It says, now then, you're getting, by removing yourself, you're causing, you're forcing the Gentiles to live like Jews. In other words, in separation. And the reason this was such an issue is because it contradicted the gospel. The gospel, as we know, as Acts 15 makes it very clear, takes away any partition between Jew and Gentile. As Peter said, God has received them just as he's received us. So this was the problem. And by his actions, he was contradicting that. So Paul sets the stage here. Let's go on to verse 10. Move on to verse 10 and see Galatians 3. First of all, let's go to the first few verses here. He set the stage. He's talking about this dichotomy, Jew and Gentile, and the problems that were growing out of that. And he's doing this as part of his background explanation in dealing with the Galatian problem that has now come up. Chapter 3, beginning in verse 1, he says, O foolish Galatians. Once again, strong language there. Who has bewitched you? It was before your eyes that Jesus Christ was publicly portrayed as crucified. Let me ask you only this. Did you receive the Spirit by works of the law or by hearing with faith? Are you so foolish? Having begun by the Spirit, are you now perfected by the flesh? And this may be, the flesh here may be an allusion to the practice of circumcision. Did you suffer so many things in vain, if indeed it was in vain? Does he who supplies the Spirit to you and works miracles among you do so by works of the law or by hearing with faith? Just as Abraham believed God and it was counted to him for righteousness. And he continues on. We won't read all of this. Skip over to verse 10. Verse 10. For all who rely on works of the law are under a curse. So here this expression, works of the law, comes up. In the same chapter, verses 23 through 25, now before faith came, we were held captive under the law, imprisoned until the coming faith should be revealed. So then the law was our guardian until Christ came, in order that we might be justified by faith. But now that faith has come, we're no longer under a guardian. Did you get that? The law was our guardian. But now that faith has come, now that Christ has come, we're no longer under a guardian. Now then, let's move on to chapter 4. Chapter 4, verse 3. He says, in the same way, we also, we Jewish converts, we Jews, we also, when we were children, were enslaved to the elementary principles of the world. And there is that same word again. The same word, the same expression, elementary principles of the world. In other translations, it is elementary spirits or elemental spirits. In the King James, it's simply elements of the world. And there's a reason that the translators differ on this. It's because that expression stoicheia tau kosmou in the Greek, that expression had different meanings at different times. But here the translators have chosen elementary principles of the world. But elements of the world, as in the KJV, is perfectly fine because it literally translates this expression, stoicheia tau kosmou, elements of the world. But it's interesting, he uses the same phrase talking about we Jews, as he used in the scripture we read at first, verses 8 through 11, in talking about the Gentile converts. So he says, we were in bondage, we were enslaved to the elementary principles of the world. But when the fullness of time came, God sent forth His Son, born of a woman, born under the law to redeem those who were under the law. And then in verse 21 to the remainder of the chapter, he contrasts Mount Sinai and the present Jerusalem with Jerusalem above. So, and then finally, look at chapter 5. Chapter 5 and verse 2, he says, look, I, Paul, say to you that if you accept circumcision, Christ will be of no advantage to you. I testify again to every man who accepts circumcision that he is obligated to keep the whole law. You are severed from Christ, you who would be justified by the law. You have fallen from grace. So this is an overview of the broader context. It is abundantly clear that those who were distorting the gospel were not Zeus-worshipping idolaters. They were, in fact, Judaizers. They were Judaizers of some sort. They had bewitched the Galatians by teaching them that justification, that is to say, a right relationship with God, was established through observance of the law. Now, in that context, in that broader context, what do you think that the days and months and seasons and years are? Well, what would that mean to a Jew? Days, wouldn't that be the weekly and annual Sabbaths? Afraid so. Months? Well, they don't. I've heard it said, well, the Jews didn't, the Hebrews didn't observe months. Well, yeah, they did. New moons? Seasons? That would be, what, festival seasons? Days of Unleavened Bread? Feast of Weeks? Feast of Tabernacles? Years? Possibly sabbatical years? And years of Jubilee? Because I'm sure the Galatians hadn't been practicing this long enough to do all those, but nevertheless, and there's another possibility, and that is if the tradition of starting the new year at Rosh Hashanah, at the Feast of Trumpets, was in place at that time. It could be a reference to that, as some commentators have pointed out. Well, let's look at Galatians 4 again, and from this perspective, let's assume for a moment that Paul is referring to Sabbaths, weekly and annual, to new moons, to festivals, and sabbatical years. In other words, the sacred times of the Old Testament. Let us assume that's what he's talking about, since everywhere you look, you see law, 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 law. It's all over the place. And then days, months, times, years, what would you say? Oh, that's pagan. Well, let's examine it from that point of view. Well, again, let's read it. It says, formerly, when you did not know God, you were enslaved to those which by nature are not gods. In other words, your former idolaters. But now that you have come to know God, or rather to be known by God, how can you turn back again to the weak and worthless elementary principles of the world whose slaves you want to be once again? Now, one way that you could explain this, if, and I'm saying if, there's a big if there, we'll come back and examine another point of view, but if this is talking about the Old Testament sacred times, then one way you can say this, how could they be going back to something they didn't observe before? Well, the point could be, and you'll find this in most commentaries, I think, that before they were under the elementary principles of pagan religion, but now they're going back to being once again enslaved to the elementary principles, but of a different sort this time. Now it's the Hebrew sacred times, it's the Hebrew religion. They're putting themselves under the law, and that includes observance of the sacred times. That's the way it's traditionally and often explained. And you have to admit that it does sort of seem to make sense on the surface, at least. Don't you admit that? I admit it. It seems to fit the context that he's talking about things, sacred times, that the Hebrews would have been aware of, the Old Testament sacred times of Sabbath days and new moons and festivals and sabbatical years. At least that's the way it looks on the surface, But In any case, that's one way of explaining it and one way of understanding it. Now, If we, let's suppose for a moment that the days and months and seasons and years do include Old Testament sacred times. Why would Paul mention them in such a negative way? Well, again, context. Context. There's something we haven't really nailed down in the context. Haven't looked at it closely enough. Throughout the book of Galatians, the problem was not the law per se. Rather, it was the problem of turning the law into a means of justification. That's what the heretics were doing. They were making the law a means of justification. It was the cause of justification. That was the problem. And therefore, if it's the cause of the justification, then that means the sacred times included in the law were part of the cause of justification. So if the Galatians were observing sacred times as a cause of salvation or of justification, then that was a problem. That was a problem. But then on the other hand, I'm not really convinced that that's what's going on here. I want you to look at verse 9. There's an expression here that perhaps we pass right over and don't really notice it. The first part of verse 9. He says, "But now that you have come to know God, or rather to be known of God, how can you turn back again to the weak and worthless elementary principles of the world?" Now that you have, if you ever notice the first part there, now that you have come to know God, and then he corrects himself a little bit. Or rather, he says, to be known of God. What does he mean by that? That's very important to the overall context. Because the problem was with the Galatians was they saw themselves as the initiators of the relationship they had with God. And the reason Paul says, rather to be known of God, and keep the word, keep the idea in mind, keep the concept in mind that the word know and known refers to an intimate and personal relationship. You have come to know God. Oh, how have I come to know Him? Well, I've been diligent, I've sought the truth, and I've done this, and I've done that, and I've done all these other things, and I have come to know God. God responded to me. And Paul, the reason he says this is, no, that's not the way it works. You've come to be known of God. You see, he reverses it. We respond to God. He initiates the relationship. We respond. It's not that we do the initiating and he does the responding. It's reverse. And this is very important to the overall context. So I say again, even if this is referring to the sacred times of the Old Testament, then the problem was that they were looking on this as a cause of salvation and not because of salvation. You get the difference? Nothing in the law is a cause of salvation, but a lot of things we do are because of the salvation we've received. There's a big difference there. But in any case, as I said before, I'm not convinced that these days and months and seasons and years are the sacred times of the Old Testament. And there are reasons for that. First of all, several points here that I want to cover. Number one is we do not know which form of Judaism is in the backdrop. We make a lot of assumptions about that, but we're not really sure. After all, this was almost 2,000 years ago. In that time, we know, and we also know that there are all kinds of things being that turn up over time, new discoveries. We find out more about the ancient world and what the concepts were and what different beliefs were. But we do know that there were Jewish mystic sects, Jewish ascetics, Jews who mixed Hellenistic philosophy with Hebrew thought, as well as your friendly neighborhood Pharisees and Sadducees and Essenes. There were fasts in the 4th and 5th and 7th and 10 months, twice weekly fasts, and a list of other fasts throughout the year. So they had all kinds of observances that were not a part of the law. So how are we to know that it wasn't some kind of other Jewish observance? So you remember the problem here is Judaizers. It's not the law per se. Just because Paul comments on the proper use of the law and the proper role of the law doesn't mean that the heretics were strictly acting according to what the law says. No, these were Judaizers. They practiced some form of Judaism. And that means that they would have been bringing in all their traditions and teaching them to the Galatians and claiming this as a cause of salvation. So, that's number one. We don't know for sure exactly who these Judaizers were. They were Judaizers, but we don't know for sure their identity. So the days and months and seasons and years are not necessarily the sacred times named in the Old Testament. Point number two, the elements of the world, the stoicheia tau kosmou, were not necessarily the ABCs. Now, this says the basic, the way this translation has it, it says the basic elements or the elementary principles, the elementary principles of the world. And in ancient times, this same expression was used in reference to the alphabet or the basic principles. Like, you know, we have our ABCs. Well, that's the basic principles of our language. That's basic to our language, basic elements of our language. And the word stoicheia would have been used in reference to the alphabet that was used at that time. Another definition was the elements that made up the universe. In those days, they thought of it in terms of four elements: water, wind, fire, and what was the other? Anyway, the four basic elements. I feel like Governor Perry answering a question. Earth, wind, water, and fire. Earth, wind, water, and fire, the four elements. Now, of course, we know that there are many, we don't think in those terms because those four basic things are made up of many other elements. A lot of you, of course, taking chemistry classes in high school or physical science classes, when you studied chemistry, you remember one of the first things you learned was about the element chart. Remember seeing up there, you know, hydrogen and oxygen and kryptonite and, well, no kryptonite. Well, all those basic elements that make up everything. And then once in a while, they'd discover a new one. They'd add it to the chart. So this word stoicheia would have been used of that, just as it would have been used of the alphabet. But there are other ways it's used. Also, the basic elements of religion. And the translators of this obviously have that in mind. And their thought is that the Galatians had been practicing certain religious elements in their old pagan faiths, and now then they've converted, and they're not to practice those things anymore, but now they're being enslaved to other elements, but still it's enslavement. That's the idea of most commentaries. So, the elements of the world, the stoicheia, tau kosmou, were not necessarily the ABCs, not necessarily the components, the physical components of the universe. They could refer to something else. In fact, there is a third possibility that I have not yet mentioned. And this is one that I think is very, very important. And even though, when you pick up the commentary, so many of them, you will find the definition or the explanation I have given to you, yet the majority of scholars would not necessarily agree with that. Let me read a few statements out of the Dictionary of Paul and His Letters. This is compiled by evangelical scholars, and some very, I think, pertinent important information is here. I'm going to read from sections. This is from the section entitled Elements/Elemental Spirits of the World, and from the section entitled Elements of the Spiritual Powers. Now, in the preceding sections, he talks about the very things I have already described. Elements as essential components of the universe, and elements as basic principles. So now then he focuses on the third use of that same expression in ancient times. And this, I think, is very important and may well shed significant light on the text we're looking at today. It says, a number of interpreters, perhaps even a majority, have concluded that ta stoicheia, tau kosmou, that's the elements of the world, refers to spiritual powers of some sort. The options, broadly defined, range from star deities to demons to angels of the nations or local tribal and national deities. So this same expression that Paul uses there in the book of Galatians was used, at least at some point in time, of the spirit world. And then under the section, the subsection here, star deities and demonic powers, the author continues, the notion that stars and constellations in some sense control the cosmos and human destiny has an ancient lineage, traceable at least as far back as the celestial divination of old Babylon in the second millennium B.C. We're talking about horoscope stuff here, if you don't know. Constellations, the stars, and he goes on to say, in time, the stars were associated with spiritual powers and then identified as spiritual powers themselves. He goes on to say, from Second Temple Judaism, there comes ample evidence of speculation about the universe and how the heavenly bodies were related to angels. The Book of the Heavenly Luminaries in 1 Enoch 72 through 82, a work dating from perhaps the first century BC, testifies to Jewish astrological ideas and the association of an angel, Uriel, with the stars. So you see, this idea of astrology, of horoscopes and the like, and of destiny and fate being determined by the motions of the stars and the heavens and so on, was not something that was restricted to paganism. It was also found in Judaism. It says this is set within a context in which particular attention is paid to times and seasons. Ah, that rings a bell, doesn't it? Times and seasons. Now, we're talking Judaism here. He goes on to say, he says, it is of some significance that Josephus could say that the woven veil separating the holy place from the outer vestibule of the Herodian temple was a kind of image of the universe. Its four colors symbolized fire, earth, air, and sea, and embroidered upon it was a panorama of the heavens, excepting the signs of the zodiac. And that's a quote from Josephus, excepting the signs of the zodiac. The latter, however, were represented by the 12 loaves, this is the signs of the zodiac, represented by the 12 loaves upon the table, while the seven lamps represented the seven planets. And this is from Josephus, Wars of the Jews, chapter 5, this is 5, 5, 4, and 5. And it goes on to say here, says, thus even at the heart of the Jerusalem temple cultus, there were symbols which suggest a necessity of penetrating the heavens in order to reach the throne of God in the Holy of Holies. The earliest extant extra-biblical Jewish evidence for the word stoicheia being associated with both spirits and stars is later than the first century, 2nd and 3rd centuries A.D., but it is well attested and may very well represent beliefs contemporaneous with Paul. So in other words, what he's saying here is that this word, this expression, stoicheia, the expression stoicheia talkosmao, is associated with demons, with the spirit world, with principalities and powers. And it's possible that Paul is using this common expression that would be recognized by Jews and Gentiles alike. It's not that he's saying he believes that the stars are spiritual powers, but it is to say that he recognizes the reality of spiritual powers by associating the heresy going on in Galatia with these things. And also in Colossians, to the Colossians, he uses the same expression. Now, I'd like to go over to another section in this book. This is under the heading of magic. It talks about Jewish magic and magic in the pagan world and so on. I'd like to read this from this one section, a subheading, The Elemental Spirits. And it refers again to the phrase that we're looking at, which is stoicheia tau kosmao. It's found in Galatians 4 and verses 3 and 9. Also, it's in Colossians 2 and verses 8 and 20. If we have time, we'll take a look at that in a few minutes. The author says, it is possible that Paul's terminology for elemental spirits of the world comes from a background of usage in astrology and magic. The expression appears, for instance, in the astrological section of the Testament of Solomon, a portion that probably had an independent existence and use as early as the first century B.C. So in all probability, this expression and that particular document, at least a part of it, was already in existence by the time Christ came. So it would already have been known. It is used there to refer to the astral decans. It goes on to define that. It says the 36 spirits controlling every 10 degrees of the heavenly sphere. In other words, this is related to astrology. The expression is used similarly in the magical papyri. If Paul was drawing the phrase stoicheia tau kosmao from the tradition represented in this literature, he did so strictly because, now get this, very important, it was part of the wide array of vocabulary shared by Jew and Gentile alike to refer to the spirit world. In this case, he may have chosen this particular expression for the powers because it was well known to the readers of Galatians and Colossians. Paul does not necessarily give credence to the notion that astral spirits hold the keys to fate. Rather, he is more concerned to subsume them under the category of the demonic and assert that by participation in Christ's death, believers have died to their enslaving influence. So it would appear from this that Paul may well have had demonic powers in view when he spoke of days and months and seasons and years. In other words, these are days and months and seasons and years in association with the so-called astral spirits, which Paul would naturally recognize as demonic, and so enslaving. Point number three, sabbatical years were not observed outside the land of promise. At least that's what we're told, to the best of our knowledge. And we don't know everything that was done back then, but it's our understanding that sabbatical years were not observed outside the land of promise. And of course, Galatia was outside the land of promise. So it is doubtful that the years that are referred to here are sabbatical years or years of jubilee. If the years were not the sabbatical years of the Old Testament, it is then doubtful that the days and the months and the seasons were the Sabbaths and new moons and festivals of the Old Testament. It must be talking about something else. And point number four is something I think is obvious on the surface, and that is if Paul meant Old Testament Sabbaths and new moons and festivals, it is curious why he used this expression, days and months and seasons and years, and didn't simply say Sabbaths and festivals. He did in Colossians, after all. Why not here? And then number five, the wording of Galatians 4, 8 through 10 at least seems to suggest that the former pagans were going back to the same, not just similar, but the same practices they had before conversion. Now, this makes all the more sense in light of what we see, that the Jews and the Gentiles observed some of the same things. So you still have the problem. The problem is coming from the Judaizers, but what they're doing is they're introducing their practice, which included astrology. That's a real possibility here. Point number six, now this is very important, I think. It is possible that the word observe, actually the word does mean, in verse 10, you observe days and months and seasons and years. That word means to carefully study. It could be translated correctly that way, to carefully study. And not necessarily to keep or perform. So to carefully watch or to carefully study, not something you're keeping or something you're performing. If that's the case, then we're talking about, it fits, astrological observances, because that's not something you actually keep, you know, but it's something that astrology gives relevance to days and months and seasons and years. It's associated with the seasons. And so you would be watching them, not necessarily performing anything. And point number seven, it just seems unlikely that Paul would have used the expression weak and worthless in reference to any of the sacred times of the Old Testament. Now, I realize that compared to the reality to which they point, which is Christ, and where justification is concerned, the holy days of the Old Testament are weak. That is to say, they can't accomplish justification. But it just seems unlikely that Paul would have used this kind of language in reference to these things that he had done all his life. And things, obviously, the New Testament church continued to do. Remember when Paul was in Jerusalem and James said, you see how many Jews there are that believe? There's a lot of them. There are thousands of them. And how they're all zealous for the law. There's no rebuke there. No problem with that. So it just seems unlikely that he would have used the expression weak and worthless in reference to the weekly Sabbath or any of the annual festivals. Look at Isaiah 56. Paul certainly was aware of this scripture. We're all familiar with it. In Isaiah 56 is a promise God gives to the foreigners who dwelt among the Israelites as well as to the eunuchs. They often felt like they didn't have a part in, you know, as far as their relationship with God was concerned. But he says, chapter 56, beginning in verse 1, says, thus says the Lord, keep justice and do righteousness, for soon my salvation will come and my deliverance be revealed. Blessed is the man who does this and the son of man who holds to it, who keeps the Sabbath, not profaning it, and keeps his hand from doing any evil. Let not the foreigner who has joined himself to the Lord say, the Lord will surely separate me from his people. And let not the eunuch say, behold, I am a dry tree. For thus says the Lord to the eunuchs who keep my Sabbaths, who choose the things that please me and hold fast my covenant, I will give in my house and within my walls a monument and a name better than the sons and daughters. I will give them an everlasting name that shall not be cut off. And the foreigners who join themselves to the Lord, to minister to him, to love the name of the Lord, and to be his servants. Everyone who keeps the Sabbath and does not profane it, but holds to my covenant, these I will bring to my holy mountain and make them joyful in my house of prayer. It seems very unlikely, given that backdrop, and certainly Paul, a Jewish rabbi, by the way, that he would certainly have been aware of that. And it seems odd and unlikely that he would use the expression weak and worthless in reference to an institution like the Sabbath day. It just seems so unlikely. So, as I put all these likelies and most likelies and less likelies and unlikelies, all these statements, you notice I keep using those words, and probablies, when I put all these items together, here's what I come up with as a plausible scenario. And again, I emphasize, we don't have all the historical facts in the backdrop. We don't have it all. But when I do put together the likelies and unlikelies and the probabilities, here's what I come up with. First, Judaism, both among the small sects and in the mainstream, had astrological observances woven into its religious and philosophical fabric. This was something the Jews and the Greeks had in common. The second point is, to convert to Christianity, however, was to abandon astrology and everything associated with it. And then the third point is, when the Gentile-born Galatian Christians were persuaded to adopt Judaism, whether mainstream or sectarian, they returned to the bondage of weak and worthless elements and once again took up the observance of, or the study of, or paying careful attention to astrologically significant days and months and seasons and years, just as the Greeks did, just as they formerly did, and just as the Jews now did. Returning to the stoicheia tau kosmou, elements of the world, meant simply once again subjecting themselves to the powers from which they had been liberated through the blood of Christ. And that's key. They were going back, they were putting themselves under the dominion of, they were enslaving themselves to the powers. And this is very important to keep in mind, especially as you look at Colossians. Now, in the time remaining, let me look quickly at the book of Colossians. Colossians chapter 2 and verses 16 and 17. Colossians 2, verses 16 and 17. Verse 16, therefore let no one pass judgment on you in questions of food and drink, or with regard to a festival or a new moon or a Sabbath. These are a shadow of things to come, but the substance belongs to Christ. Or as the King James says, the body is of Christ, or the body of Christ. Christ is the body that casts the shadow. Let no one disqualify you in insisting on asceticism and worship of angels. You get that? Worship of angels? The powers? Principalities and powers? Well, let's get a little context here. Let's go back and look at chapter 1, first of all. Chapter 1, and beginning in verse 15, talking about Christ, Paul says, He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For by Him all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities. All things were created through Him and for Him. And He is before all things, and in Him all things hold together. And He is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that is, in everything He might have preeminence. So He's not only Lord over the church, the head of the church, He's head over all creation, over all principalities and powers. Whether you're talking about human thrones and dominions, or you're talking about the thrones and dominions, or the principalities and powers of the spirit world. This is very important in the context here. Very important. With that in mind, and you could read that whole section there sometimes, but keep in mind Romans 13, for example. We're not going to turn there, but it says here that Christ is head of all dominions and rulers and powers. That includes the human governments. And that's why we're told to submit to the authorities that be, because there is no authority that is not of God. What that means is not saying that every despot that comes along that God assigned him, appointed him to that position, and we're supposed to do whatever he says, even if he tells us to do things that are opposed to God's law. No, that's not what it means at all. What it means is all legitimate forms of authority flow from God. He's the origin of all of it. Whether you're talking about human authorities or whether you're talking about authorities that we know as the principalities and powers that make up the spirit world, angels and even demons. Of course, demons are, that's an example of the abuse of authority. But the point is, Christ is head not only of the church, but of the whole cosmos. including the powers, as they're called here. Colossians 2, continuing to get a broader context for the statement. Colossians 2, beginning in verse 6, "Therefore, as you received Christ Jesus the Lord, so walk in Him, rooted and built up in Him and established in the faith, just as you were taught, abounding in thanksgiving. So see to it that no one takes you captive by philosophy and empty deceit, according to human tradition." It's not talking about the law here. The human tradition, according to the, here's that expression again. This way, this time it's translated this way in this translation. The elemental spirits of the world. Same expression. "And not according to Christ, for in Him the whole fullness of deity dwells bodily." And this is saying that Christ, hasn't just been invested with a divine nature. He hasn't just been invested with some kind of a divinity, like an energy flowing from God. It says, in Him dwells the fullness of deity, the fullness of God. That's what He's talking about here. That's what makes Him Lord of all creation. "And you have been filled in Him who is the head of all rule and authority. In Him also you were circumcised with a circumcision made without hands by putting off the body of the flesh by the circumcision of Christ," talking about the cutting of His flesh, His crucifixion, "having been buried with Him in baptism, in which you were also raised with Him through faith in the powerful working of God who raised Him from the dead. And you were dead in your trespasses and the uncircumcision of your flesh, God made alive together with Him, having forgiven us all our trespasses." Now, how did He do that? Well, He canceled, by canceling the record of debt that stood against us with its legal demands. That's a better translation than what you'll find in the King James Version. He canceled the record of debt. He's not nailing any law to the cross here. "This He set aside, nailing it to the cross," or stake, or whatever word you want to use. Now, notice in connection with this, in connection with His nailing the record of debt to the stake, what else is associated with it here? He disarmed the rulers and authorities and put them to open shame. Who are the rulers and authorities? He's talking about the spirit world, the stoicheia. That's who He's talking about here. By triumphing over them in Him. Now, how did His nailing of the record of debt, in other words, our record of sins, His nailing of our record of sins to His stake, what does that have to do with His triumph over and His disarming of rulers and authorities? Well, simply this. Satan is called the accuser of the brethren, isn't he? What does he accuse us of? Our sins. What does he point to in accusing us? Our record of sins. But guess what? If Christ has removed that record and there is no longer any debt, there is no record of sins, then what does the accuser of the brethren point to? He's been disarmed, hasn't he? He's been disarmed. And the language that's used here is interesting because any Roman living in that day would recognize it right away, I'm sure. Probably the Jews did too. It says, put them to an open shame by triumphing over them in Him or in it, in His death. Put them to an open shame. The allusion here, the metaphor in the backdrop is simply this. In ancient times, when the Roman generals won a war, they defeated the enemy, they would ride in with their heads high, victoriously on a white horse, into the city of Rome. And behind them, in shackles, would be the defeated enemy. And it was an open shame, of course, to the cheers of the Roman crowd. And so what he's saying here, essentially, he's using that to describe his conquest over the spirit world. And it is interesting that in this context, he uses that same expression, which is translated elsewhere, elements of the world, the stoicheia. So it seems obvious that he has the spirit world in mind when he uses that expression. Now, what does that have to do then with the next verse? Let's read it again. Therefore, verse 16, let no one pass judgment on you in questions of food and drink, or with regard to a festival, or a new moon, or a Sabbath. These are a shadow of things to come, but the substance belongs to Christ. Let no one disqualify you, insisting on asceticism and worship of angels. Worship of angels. That ties right in with the elements of the world. going on in detail about visions, puffed up without reason by his sensuous mind and not holding fast to the head from which the whole body, nourished and knit together through its joints and ligaments, grows with a growth that is from God. Well, you see, the whole point here is that these heretics, by focusing on their rules of asceticism and applying them in some way to the fellowship that these people were having in their eating and their drinking and their enjoyment of the Sabbaths and festivals, by doing that, they were turning the focus away from the real source of justification and salvation. You see, it was substituting that for the real thing. That's why he speaks in such condemning language here. Now, I'd like to read one more brief section from this book, from the section entitled Holy Days, and from the subtitle Holy Days in the Pauline Corpus. First of all, he comments on Galatians 4. I want to read that first. He said, "The observing might be studying such times," as I pointed out a little while ago. In other words, you observe days and months and seasons and years. In other words, the study of days and months, seasons, years, as the inclusion of years might suggest, rather than performing them. And it is clear that astrology was widely pervasive and deeply influential in Greco-Roman and Jewish daily life. The elements are likely to be either those of the earth, air, fire, and water, as generally in ancient cosmology, or the heavenly bodies, which control fate in the ancient astrology. Either way, they're closely linked to the sun, moon, and seasons. Of course, sun, moon, and seasons, days, months, seasons, and years. Now, concerning Colossians, he says this, Colossians 2. He says, "The switch from you to us, presumably us Jews, suggests that the law is again in view. Its calendrical observance is characterized as mere shadow," although the word mere is not in the Greek text, which is skia, the word skia, "in contrast with the reality, the soma, which is Christ. But it is not stated that the two," that's the shadow and the reality, "are mutually exclusive." This is very important here now. This is coming from an evangelical scholar who doesn't observe these days, by the way. "The judgment," says, "let no man judge you." Someone was judging them. Says, "the judgment seems to be criticism of the Christian's present practice, apparently, of eating and drinking and enjoying Jewish festivals in contrast to those whose watchword was do not handle, do not taste, and do not even touch." So it seems that those whose watchword was do not handle, do not taste, do not touch, obviously they were practicing asceticism. And this was in relation to what Paul calls the worship of angels. In other words, some kind of obsession with or association with the spirit world, which, as we have established, was associated with the stoicheia, tau kosmou, the elements of the world. And so it's pretty clear that that's what's going on here. Now then, what we might come up with, what we might conclude from all this then, is that certainly sacred times are appropriate. They always have been. They always will be. But it's important to realize that they're not a cause of salvation, but they're because of salvation. When we come together for the Passover, the Days of Unleavened Bread, for the Feast of Weeks, all the other annual festivals and holy days, we're not coming together because we're attempting to gain salvation from it. We're coming together to rejoice and celebrate and have fellowship with each other because of the salvation we have received from the one that all these days point to, Jesus Christ. So that's the message in the elements of the world. We can approach them in a wrong way. We can begin to add certain components to them that would make them useless. We can add components to them that would even miss the point altogether. The focus should be, as always, on the head of the body, the head of all things, the head of all principality and power, Jesus Christ.